Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. We'll be focusing on the Ukraine crisis again this week. I'm in Arizona for just one more week of this year, and it's been bloody hard to arrange any interviews here with the people and organizations I'd hope to hook up with. It seems everyone is working from home these days, and media coverage of the work they do just isn't seem to be a priority. Maybe if I were representing a larger national media network, folks would take it more seriously. Still, I managed to bring you voices and perspectives most other outlets in the Signal area don't, so I guess the service is still meaningful in that regard. Today's show, though consisting mostly of recordings I've gathered from rather than interviews I've conducted, will follow in that tradition. I've hesitated to broadcast anything from actor, commenter, and podcaster Russell Brand, not because I've disagreed with him or felt that what he has to say isn't valuable, but rather it's his hyper-enthusiastic speaking style that's just a bit over the top. His analysis on Ukraine, however, and in particular on the U.S. media coverage of it, has been especially poignant, so we'll hear his latest on that subject. We'll also hear an interview between economist Richard Wolff and political historian and author Chris Hedges, which touches on Ukraine but deals more with the state of the U.S. economy and the crisis of capitalism in general. First, however, I want to read you an op-ed that was published a little over a week ago in the People's Daily World, the national newspaper of the Communist Party USA. Now, the Communist Party in the U.S. is not aligned in any way with Putin or Russia. They're decidedly anti-imperialist, and Putin is, by any definition, an imperialist, and a dangerous one at that. But in this op-ed, the author takes a look at the historical facts and trends leading up to this point and points an accusing finger at the U.S. as a key architect of the present circumstances. One could very well argue that Putin could have chosen not to invade Ukraine, and we can rightly condemn him for doing so. But I want to pose this question in light of the fact that the U.S. has had ample opportunities to prevent this war and is still negating diplomatic paths toward ending it. If Martin Luther King said that riots are the language of the unheard, is war at least a predictable response to a nation's legitimate grievances being unheeded while a foreign military noose tightens around its neck? And while I don't mean to compare Putin's unjust invasion with civil unrest in the U.S. over issues of police brutality and racial oppression, I'm concerned more here with those who condemn those riots and therefore dismiss their causes. Are we not doing the same now in Russia? We are not wrong to condemn the invasion, but if we ignore the circumstances that preceded it and therefore fail to address them, then, like those who condemn the so-called riots here and refuse to acknowledge the prevalence and ubiquity of racism and racial inequality, are we not abdicating any pretense of valuing justice? We turn now to Russell Brand from a recent podcast. I've edited out some of the intros and podcast promos here. The op-ed is titled, "Russia May Have Fallen Into a Ukraine Trap Set by the U.S. by C.J. Atkins. It reads, "Fresh analysis is pointing toward the conclusion that with the invasion of Ukraine, Russia may have stepped into an Afghanistan-style trap set by the U.S. in launching a criminal invasion of its neighbor and thus economically isolating itself from much of the rest of the world. The Kremlin has effectively done exactly what the U.S. and NATO wanted." That, according to Robert H. Wade, professor of global political economy at the London School of Economics. In an extensive analytical article just published by LSE, Wade argues that although Russia's actions in Ukraine are inexcusable, the designs for the current war were drawn up more in Washington than in Moscow. His contention is that a long drawn-out conflict in the Ukraine and punishing sanctions now being inflicted on the people of Russia are components of a plan to eventually bring down the government of Vladimir Putin and replace it with one which is more compliant with the U.S. dominance of the world, a new, weaker administration akin to that of former President Boris Yeltsin in the 1990s. Wade writes that there exists a, quote, long-standing U.S. strategy for regime change in Moscow with Ukraine as the pivot, unquote. The self-determination of the Ukrainian nation and the lives of the people of Ukraine are pieces of what former U.S. National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski called the grand chessboard of maneuvers centered on sustaining U.S. primacy in the world. It's a plan that has played out over the course of several U.S. presidencies, and it reflects the geopolitical strategy of the U.S. imperialist state as a whole, and not simply the foreign policy of the Biden administration alone. exploiting legitimate Russian security worries combined with the Putin government's own imperial ambitions made setting the trap rather straightforward, if not a simple affair. Taking advantage of Russia's weakness following the downfall of the Soviet Union, the U.S. moved to ensure it would never again face a challenger to its dominance in Europe. The U.S.-led NATO alliance steadily expanded eastward in the 1990s and 2000s, with countries formerly aligned with the USSR like Poland and the Czech Republic, Bulgaria, and Romania all being eagerly welcomed. The Ukraine was the biggest prize, Wade says, quoting a 2013 admission from Carl Gershman, director of the National Endowment for Democracy, a front for U.S. interference in other nations. In 2014, a year after Gershman painted a target on Ukraine, the government of President Viktor Yanukovych was overthrown in a coup led by Western-aligned business figures and right-wing nationalists, with the close assistance of the U.S. State Department. The new U.S.-backed government issued a number of provocative decrees aimed at the Russian-speaking eastern regions in the Donbass area. The day immediately after Yanukovych was forced from office, Russia lost its status as an official language alongside Ukrainian, and Russian-language news, television, and radio were all proscribed. Unsurprisingly, the new government's actions prompted resistance in the Donbass and increased sentiment for leaving Ukraine. In response, the government in Kyiv launched an offensive against the breakaway province, resulting in a civil war that took nearly 1,500 lives over the 8 years before Putin's invasion. Meanwhile, since 2015, the CIA has been conducting a secret program to provide intensive special operations training to select Ukraine paramilitary units and intelligence agents in preparation for a war with Russia. Instruction took place in Ukraine, but Ukrainians were also brought to the U.S. for more specialized training. The covert scheme was initiated by the Obama administration, expanded under Trump, and further augmented by Biden. The CIA has insisted that the program, already 7 years old, is all a defensive affair, but a media report from January 2022, just before the Russian invasion, one former CIA official anonymously confirmed the United States is training for an insurgency. Speaking bluntly, the former official added that the whole point of the operation was to teach Ukrainians how to kill Russians. Wade contended that the current war is likely still preventable, up till December of 2021 or even later. The Kremlin presented treaty proposals, which included implementation of an 8-year-old Minsk peace accords, which include a commitment that Ukraine will not join NATO, dissolving extreme-right Ukrainian militias, and engaging in serious negotiation about a new security architecture in Europe, he reminds readers. The U.S. and NATO consistently refused to negotiate, Wade points out. He speculates that it may have been Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's February 19th speech at the Munich Security Conference, which left Putin firm in his decision to launch an invasion. Zelensky said there would be a clear path for Ukraine to join NATO and expressed regret that Ukraine had surrendered its nuclear weapons when the Soviet Union fell apart. That same week, the Organization for Security Cooperation in Europe reported that the Ukrainian military forces dramatically stepped up their artillery shelling of the Russian ethnic areas in Donbass, likely with U.S. and NATO approval. When Putin ordered his troops across the Ukrainian border on February 24th, Wade argues the Russian leader took the bait put out by the West. In crafting his analysis, Wade goes to great lengths to make the point that seeing the Ukraine war as a trap set by the U.S. does not excuse Russia's actions. He's no Putin apologist. Rather, he makes a comparison to the situation of former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. In 1990, the U.S. set a trap for Hussein. When Iraq was involved in a dispute with the government of Kuwait, Washington assured its former ally it would not interfere in any fight between the two. When Hussein invaded Kuwait, however, it gave the U.S. justification needed to destroy Iraq militarily and economically. Like Hussein, Putin makes the convenient villain. His invasion was a clear violation of international law. It trampled on the sovereignty of Ukraine, which still matters no matter what one's opinions of the current Ukrainian government's legitimacy are. And, by most accounts, Russian forces have executed their orders with brutal enthusiasm. These realities have made it easier to coalesce public opinion against Russia in many countries. Returning to Brzezinski, Wade's analysis suggests that the Ukraine trap is even more similar to the one set for the USSR by the CIA in Afghanistan in the late 1970s. At that time, the U.S. secretly began funding the armed Mujahideen groups, Islamist fundamentalist guerrilla fighters, against the socialist government of Afghanistan, with the hope of provoking the Soviet Union to intervene on behalf of its ally. The plan worked, and in late 1979, Soviet forces entered Afghanistan at the request of Afghan authorities. They wouldn't leave for another 10 years, just as the Soviet Union itself was on the verge of death. The National Security Advisor to then-President Jimmy Carter, Brzezinski, was the architect of that plot. Wade quotes Brzezinski's memories of the plan, quote, "That secret operation was an excellent idea. It had the effect of drawing the Russians into the Afghan trap, and if you want me to regret it, the day the Soviets officially crossed the border, I wrote to President Carter, essentially, we now have the opportunity of giving the USSR its Vietnam War." Unquote. Today, of course, there are no socialist or progressive governments involved in any side of this conflict. Instead, there's a confrontation of imperial powers and the states being used as pawns in a grand U.S. strategy, and perhaps less than grand Russian one. And with the Kremlin now admitting to significant losses and pulling back its forces to focus on the battle of eastern Ukraine, it would appear that it is the U.S. plan and not the Russian one, which is coming to fruition so far. The next step in the U.S. strategy, according to Wade, consists of two parts, both of which are already in motion. First, Washington and its allies will continue supplying Ukraine with sufficient weaponry to sink the Russian military further into a quagmire, but not enough to actually deal a decisive blow to Putin's forces. The goal is to make the war long and costly as possible for Russia, and not actually to defend Ukrainian independence or sovereignty necessarily. The second prong of the strategy is sanctions. The U.S. has rallied its allies and dependent states to impose severe sanctions on the Russian economy, while the media focuses on the oligarchs hit by the trade and financial restrictions. The primary target is the living standards of the Russian working class and middle class. The U.S. hopes that the weapons plus sanctions strategy will last long enough for the Russians to overthrow Putin and install a Yeltsin-like president more sympathetic to the West, Wade says. He believes the words of Biden and other Western leaders in recent weeks reveal the desired endgame. "For God's sake, this man cannot remain in power," Biden said in Warsaw on March 26th earlier. And on February 24th, the president admitted the sanctions were not intended to prevent the invasion, but rather to punish, so the people of Russia would know that Putin had brought on them. The British Armed Forces Minister James Heapy similarly declared that the sanctions are meant to ensure that Putin's days as president will be numbered. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian said that the intention is to asphyxiate Russia's economy. And the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's spokesperson said in early March that the sanctions are to bring down the Putin regime. Of course, the objectives of the U.S. and NATO in this war go beyond simply engineering the overthrow of the Putin government. There's also the need to keep Russia as an enemy, even if a more pliable puppet were to be put in charge of that country. Maintaining the view that Russia is a threat backs up the supposed need for U.S. leadership in the world. It keeps NATO united and justifies major increases in military spending in the U.S., but also in Europe and in Germany in particular. Having big nation-state adversaries like Russia and maybe China surely brings in higher profits for arms manufacturers than campaigns against smaller threats like terrorist groups or rogue enemies in the developing world. For those against the war and profiteering, there is no side to back in this war. Both Putin's illegal invasion and the U.S.-NATO regime change game should be opposed. The people of Ukraine are paying the price for this war with their cities, their towns, their homes, and their lives. The people of Russia, meanwhile, are on the receiving end of some of the most severe economic warfare measures ever. Those of us in the NATO countries are paying too. Inflation and soaring fuel prices are already eroding our wages and living standards. But even more than that, we'll be paying for generations to come as billions of dollars flow away from things like healthcare and housing and toward bombs and fighter jets. When it comes to the senseless destruction and profiteering of war, it's not just Russia that has fallen into the trap. We're all caught now, and only a mass mobilization for de-escalation, detente, and demilitarization can get us out. That was an essay in the People's Daily World, published 2 weeks ago by C.J. Atkins. I've also read reports that the peace movement or anti-war movement in the UK has been calling for halting arms sales to Ukraine and for a diplomatic end to the war.
This war is a simple black and white thing. Either Putin is evil or NATO started it. But when did the war in Ukraine really start? And who really started it? What we really want to understand today is how did this situation really begin? Of course, you could have what is called infinite regress. Oh, because of Stalin. Oh, because of American colonialism. Because of British imperialism. But a very important time in the escalation of this conflict was 2014. And it's that in particular we're going to talk about today. Because it seems to me that when you're talking about the neo-Nazi component, American interventionism, this was a key episode in the situation we find ourselves in today. Let's have a look at it. Now, obviously, what we're offering you is an alternative to mainstream media. To them, the war in Ukraine is a simple situation. Putin is evil. And then other people counter with the escalation of NATO hostility as to the culpability being on the other side of the fence. Nearly a decade on, the 2014 Revolution of Dignity, as it's known in Ukraine, remains one of the more widely misunderstood episodes of recent history. Yet understanding it is critical to understanding the ongoing standoff over Ukraine, which can largely be traced back to this polarizing event. Like today's Russia-NATO tensions, more broadly at the heart of the Maidan protests was the push by some Western governments, especially in the United States, to isolate Russia by supporting the integration of peripheral parts of the former Soviet Union into European and Atlantic institutions, and Moscow's pushback against what it saw as an encroachment on its sphere of influence. Presumably, although it was much protested against, at the time of the war in Vietnam, you wouldn't be able to say, hey, this is a proxy war. It's no one's business what goes on in Vietnam. We now know and are able to understand it was a proxy war between communists from Russia, American colonialism, and that's like completely appreciated and fully understood. At the time, even though there was a massive countercultural civil rights movement that was opposed to that war because of the draft and numerous other reasons, there still would have been a mainstream narrative that was like, we absolutely have to do this in Vietnam. I like even having it explained to me that there was an intention between America and Europe to create institutions in former Soviet nations, because for 50 years, the Cold War had been the dominant threat to global stability. And it was a truly polarizing event. A lot of you have mentioned in the comments below about the Cuban Missile Crisis and how when Russia were willing to put missiles in Cuba, how that very nearly brought about the Third World War, and of drawing comparisons between the militarization of Ukraine and other surrounding former Soviet states and that event, how it is, in essence, a hostile encroachment upon Russian sovereignty. That is one component of this complex and sophisticated geopolitical issue. A major turning point in the US-Ukraine-Russia relationship was the 2014 violent and unconstitutional ouster of President Viktor Yanukovych, elected in 2010, a vote heavily split between eastern and western Ukraine. In 2014, Yanukovych was taking his second crack at the Ukrainian presidency. Once in power, Yanukovych's rule was again marred by widespread corruption, authoritarianism, and for some, an uncomfortable friendliness to Moscow, which had made no secret of its backing him in the previous election. The fact that Ukraine was starkly divided between a more Europe-friendly Western centre and a more pro-Russia East, the same lines that largely determined the election, only added to the complication. Ukraine relied on cheap gas from Russia, but a plurality of the country, not crucially an absolute majority, still wanted European integration. You can see that this is already complex. There was a leader in place that many believed to be corrupt. There are territorial divisions. There are alliances between former regimes, the former Soviet regime in the form of Russia, a desire for European integration. So this war, this conflict is occurring amid a degree of complexity. It's already, just reading this, not as simple as that Putin, He's a bastard. He might be a bastard. None of this, of course, is an attempt to negate the transgressions made by Russia under Putin. That seems to be a foregone and understood aspect of this conflict. It's simply to point out that due to the nature of geopolitics, due to the nature of globalization, due to the nature of centralization, you're going to be dealing with a lot of interconnected issues. It's not going to be, oh no, there's some baddies, what are we going to do? And I think that whenever you find yourself supporting the intentions of a particular group in a way that lacks nuance, you are beholden to investigate your own position. Like, why is it that I believe that Putin's just evil and there's no discussion to be had? Stand with Ukraine. Of course, stand with Ukraine. Of course, don't bomb people. Of course, don't kill people. Those are some issues we can immediately agree on. War and violence are wrong and bad. But if we're truly going to find an amenable solution, we're going to have to understand the nature of the problem. His political career was caught in the same bind. With his party formally allied to Vladimir Putin's own United Russia Party, his pro-Russia base wanted to see closer relations with its neighbour. But the oligarchs, who were the real reason he'd gotten anywhere near the presidency, were financially entangled with the West. And they feared competition to their grip on the country from across the Russian border. All the while, two geopolitical powers in the form of Washington and Moscow hoped to use these cleavages, grow up, to draw the country into their respective orbits. Yeah, of course, because the centralized powers of America and Russia do need to simplify the narrative because they have a solution and an agenda in mind. The only way you could actually get anywhere with this is to let go of an outcome, right? You'd have to go, all we want is peace and for people not to be harmed and for ordinary people to have as much power in their own lives as possible. As soon as you go, I'd like it if the outcome was financially beneficial to the United States of America, or I'd like it if we were able to control these resources, or it would be good for us politically to control that territory, as long as that's in the mix, as long as the serpent of self-will is intermingled with your requirement for particular outcomes, you are never going to achieve a peaceful outcome. You will achieve a malign and self-interested one. The backdrop to the 2014 coup and annexation cannot be understood without looking at the US strategy to open Ukrainian markets to foreign investors and give control of its economy to giant multinational corporations. What? America? Trying to open up new markets. Hide. How dare you? How could you even? What evidence? When is there previous history of America trying to open up markets to global conglomerates? Oh, yeah. Always, all the time, with every single war there's ever been. A key tool for this has been the International Monetary Fund, which leverages aid loans to push governments to adopt policies friendly to foreign investors. These groups like IMF, they all pose as like these neutral agencies, but they've all got funding, they've all got an agenda, they're all working in collusion with corporate interests. We will lend you some money, go on, as long as you keep talking, do exactly what we tell you. The IMF is funded by and represents Western financial capital and governments and has been at the forefront of efforts to reshape economies around the world for decades. Reshape economies. That's take over sovereign nations. We'd just like to reshape your economy. Reshape economies around the world for decades, often with disastrous results. The civil war in Yemen and the coup in Bolivia both followed a rejection of IMF terms. Oh, what a coincidence. Are you slowly awakening to the realities of geopolitics and the way that it is underwritten by required outcomes of corporate interest? In Ukraine, the IMF had long planned to implement a series of economic reforms to make the country more attractive to investors. Not the people who live there, investors. In 2013, after early steps to integrate with the West, Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych turned against these changes and ended trade integration talks with the European Union. Months before his overthrow, he restarted economic negotiations with Russia in a major snub to the Western economic sphere. By then, the nationalist protests were heating up that would go on to topple his government. Okay, so this dude was starting to snub Western and European interests in favour of Russian interests. Whether you believe that's right or wrong, that's, you know, up for you to determine and decide while picking through this complex information. But what it starts to make me think is the kind of sanctimony and piety of Western support of the situation in Ukraine has to be queried a little bit. Stand with Ukraine! Stand with them! Because there's a little wrinkle in this where people were trying to set Ukraine up so that foreign investment opportunities would be presented. They weren't like, oh God, what can we do for Ukrainian people? If Ukrainian people are helped, that's a byproduct of their financial interests. His ouster came after months of protests led in part by far-right extremists. Weeks before his ouster, an unknown party leaked a phone call between US officials discussing who should and shouldn't be part of the new government and finding ways to seal the deal. After the ouster, a politician the officials designated as the guy even became prime minister. Okay, so there was this insurrection that occurred, whether you agree with it or not, because you maybe think that old Yanukovych weren't the world's greatest guy. And the chances are that he probably bloody well wasn't. The fact was there was Western intervention in the government of Ukraine. As political turmoil engulfed the country in the lead up to 2014, the US was fueling anti-government sentiment through mechanisms like USAID and National Endowment for Democracy, NED, just as they had done in 2004. In December 2013, Victoria Nuland, Assistant Secretary of the State for European Affairs and longtime regime change advocate, said that the US government had spent $5 billion promoting democracy in Ukraine since 1991. $5 billion promoting democracy. Whose democracy? For who? Like, it's like, oh God, we've just got to help Ukrainian people. Come on, let's promote democracy. Do you get anything out of this? Oh God, I suppose down the line there could be these political advantages and these economic advantages, but as long as democracy's okay. If you care about democracy so much, do it in your own bloody country. The NED is a key organisation in the network of American soft power that pours $170 million a year into organisations dedicated to defending or installing US-friendly regimes. So this is a thing that goes on. You can't simply just absorb the crap that flows out of mainstream corporate media. You can't just watch that and go, oh no, Putin's bad, oh no. There's a whole set of agencies dedicated to destabilizing unfriendly regimes and installing regimes that are friendly to American business interests. One thing that I've thought for a while is British colonization was all done very upfront. Dun, 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 dun. We're here on behalf of the Queen to nick your country. And then we realized you can't do that. People don't like it. We have to give all the countries back to the people we'd nicked them off. So America was like, what if we never actually overtly steal a country? We just replace all of their structures, profit from their minerals and business interests, and nobody needs to know what's happening. Now the true nations are the corporate nations. Now the true interests and powers are the corporate powers, and the governments are merely the facilitators of their interests. Discuss. Comments below. The Washington Post's David Ignatius once wrote that the organization functions by doing in public what the CIA used to do in private. Wow. Destabilizing governments and installing friendly regimes. The NED targets governments who oppose US military or economic policy, stirring up anti-government opposition. While this is still not conclusive about why the war in Ukraine is happening, it is important information. That's not nothing. All of that's not, oh, that's all irrelevant. It's just Putin's evil. He's the new Hitler, is what he is. That is an attempt to borrow an existing narrative, to flatten out, iron out nuance and prevent you saying, God, I don't know that we really understand what's happening here. The solution probably involves a wide range of things, like NATO not encroaching on that territory, like America ain't going to intervene in the democratic process of sovereign nations, which America aren't able to do because all of their relationships with corporations, the very corporations that fund the two political parties in America, are contingent on pledges of that nature being made. Oh, we can predict the profits will go up this much because we're going to have access to these resources. We can predict your profits are going to go up this much because there's going to be a war and we're going to be selling it. You know, this is where reality takes place. There are two economies. There are two realities. There's the reality that we are fed in order to keep us compliant and docile. Then there's the reality that underscores that, the actual reality, the reality that they don't trust us with, the reality that we're not informed about, the reality that you have to take responsibility both on an inward trajectory and an outward trajectory to understand. You have to make yourself familiar with that because you're not going to receive that information elsewhere. And it's absolutely vital. The US involvement was part of a campaign aimed at exploiting the divisions in Ukrainian society to push the country into the US sphere of influence, pulling it out of the Russian sphere. So no doubt there was complexity in Ukraine prior to that, but these fissures were exploited. Why? Not to help Ukrainian people, in order to create economic opportunity. In the aftermath of the overthrow, Russia illegally annexed Crimea from Ukraine. So that was bad. In part to secure a major naval base from the new Ukrainian government. The New York Times and Washington Post both omitted the role the US played in these events. Why? Why would you? Because it creates complexity. In US media, this critical moment in history is completely cleansed of US influence, erasing a critical step on the road to the current war. That's key, huh? The 2014 revolution in Ukraine was an enormously complicated affair. Yet for most Western observers, many of its basic, well-documented facts have been either excised to push a simplistic black-and-white narrative or cast as misinformation and propaganda, like the crucial role of the far right in the revolution. In truth, the Maidan Revolution remains a messy event that isn't easy to categorise, but is far from what Western audiences have been led to believe. It's a story of liberal, pro-Western protesters driven by legitimate grievances, but largely drawn from only one half of a polarised country, entering a temporary marriage of convenience with the far right to carry out an insurrection against a corrupt authoritarian president. That's a complicated plot, right? Okay, so you've got a polarised nation, you've got progressive pro-Western protesters, but they're making a marriage of convenience with far-right Nazis. That's so complicated. The sort of ideas that start to appear in my head when I hear that level of complexity is, why would you centralise such a diverse group of interests? Who benefits from having one centralised government? Why are we not having libertarian, anarcho-syndicalist systems of government where communities are made as small as possible, not as large as possible, as small as can possibly be effective? What is the advantage of scaling? Who benefits from power being centralised? Those are the kind of questions I would be asking. The tragedy is that it served to largely empower literal neo-Nazis. If there's one thing we can agree on, is there? That we don't want Nazis? Can we agree on that? No matter where you are on the political scale? While enacting only the goals of the Western powers that opportunistically lent their support, among which was the geopolitical equivalent of a predatory payday loan. So they offer them financial solutions based on compliance. And one could argue that the current war is in part a result of the conditions that were set out here. It's a story tragically common in post-Cold War Europe of a country maimed and torn apart when its political and social divisions were used and wrenched further apart in the tussle of great power rivalry. And the Western failure to understand it has led us to a point where Washington continues to recklessly involve itself in a place full of shadowy motives, shifting allegiances, and where little is what it seems on the surface. None of this is to say that Putin's invasion is justified, but calling it unprovoked distracts attention from the US's own contribution to this disastrous outcome. The US ignored warnings from both Russia and US officials that a major conflagration could erupt if the US continued its path, and it shouldn't be surprising that one eventually did. Now, as the world once again inches towards the brink of nuclear omnicide, it's more important than ever for Western audiences to understand and challenge their own government's role in dragging us all to this point. What I take from this is that we're dealing with a situation of almost unimaginable complexity, with numerous players, with shifting ideals, and no one is free from guilt in the creation of this conflagration. As the writer of this brilliant piece suggests, all of us should think about our own personal autonomy and perhaps a little more tangentially, the type of governments we have and the type of interests that our governments truly represent. The war in Ukraine is a tragedy for the people that are dealing with the reality of conflict, the reality of being displaced, the reality of losing people they love. But to simplify the narrative does them a greater disservice to say simply that Putin is an evil expansionist, even though he may be, while neglecting to include vital information that the political interests and economic interests of our own governments and agencies that are set up primarily to support financial and corporate interests led us in this direction. That there are various ways that this crisis could have been averted if true democracy were allowed to flourish. In our own communities and our own lives, let us insist upon transparency. Let us insist upon democracy. And now we have a situation such as the one in Ukraine. We have to be open and clear about it and resist the attempt to marshal and shepherd us into simplistic thinking, piety, sanctimony, and further foolishness, because the people of Ukraine deserve better. And the only way the world will significantly change is if we are able to change our consciousness and our understanding of such complex situations.
Richard Wolff is an economist and a democratic socialist, though not aligned with any political party. He has been featured on this show previously and is frequently a guest on Democracy Now! In this segment, Wolff interviews author and historian Chris Hedges. They touch on Ukraine, but most of their discussion is about the decline of imperial capitalism and the threats we face as the owning class turns to ever more brutal means to maintain their wealth and power.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. Today, I'll be discussing nurses' suicides, rising inflation, rising U.S. corporate profits, and more. And after the break, I'm happy to tell you we'll be talking to my friend, author, writer, journalist, Chris Hedges. Nurses are committing suicide in record numbers, and they have been now for a year, year and a half. It reminds me of those stories a while back about workers in overstressed Chinese factories, Foxconn and other big factories over there, committing suicide because they were overstressed. But I'm happy to report that the nurses are now organizing and trying to do something. And I want to say something about their situation so it's understood. Some of the media accounts refer to the fact, I kid you not, that there's a mental health care crisis among the nurses. I would like respectfully to disagree. No. There's nothing wrong with the mental health of our nurses. What we have is a level of stress that no one should be subjected to. Here's what's happened. We've had, COVID. And that has certainly made the environment of our whole medical profession much more stressed. But we could have and should have prepared for it. We could have and should have had the clinics, had the nurses, had the personnel in place to deal with the viruses we know periodically afflict us. That's a system failure, not a nurse failure, not a mental health problem. And here's what's made it much worse. That we now organize more and more of our hospitals as capitalist, profit-driven corporations. And they're, of course, doing what profit-making always does, which is, I'll use their language, economizing on labor costs. Nurses are labor costs. Orderlies, the people who work with nurses, they are labor costs. You cut them, and those that remain are overworked, overstressed, and even driven to suicide. And one last point. We, the public, depend on the nurses and the orderlies to deal with us when we have to go to hospitals and clinics. It's good for us that the nurses are fighting for a better labor situation. It makes our care number one rather than corporate profits number one, which is the root of the problem. I want to talk next about one of the many side effects, if you like, of the sanctions imposed by the United States, the United Kingdom, and other countries against Russia as a consequence of the invasion of Ukraine. And this one has to do with Canada. Canada is an interesting country because it occupies a geography quite like Russia, and it has under its soil resources quite like Russia. And here's a lesson we can learn. As Russia gets frozen out of the world economy, at least that's the goal of the sanctions, as the people imposing them from President Biden on down tell us, well then, understandably, people who needed exports of raw materials and so on from Russia have turned to Canada because it has the similar products. And the Canadians, of course, seeing profit, are trying to respond. But here's the problem. A sudden increase in demand means that Canada discovering it doesn't have the rail cars to move the stuff. It doesn't have the machinery to get the stuff. It doesn't, you see the problem? And here's what's happening. The demand in Canada is driving up the prices because people are so needful of replacing Russian material that the Canadians can raise the price for everyone, which means inflation for everyone. The sanction program is creating supply chain bottlenecks that are driving up inflation everywhere. Think about it the next time you hear someone, oh, like President Trump, remember, trade wars are easy to win. And not so quick. Yours against China didn't win, and this one is running into more and more problems. It's not so clear who's the economic winner and loser on this one. My next update has to do with a survey. Oxfam America did a survey of all the states, all 50 states in the United States, asking a simple question. What percentage of each state's workers earned $15 per hour or less? Let me begin by telling you that $15 an hour, if you work nearly full time, 40 hours a week, nearly all the weeks of the year except one or two, and if you subtract the Social Security that's withheld from your pay, you're going to be earning well under 30 grand a year. That's a full-time worker. You know what that puts you? Real close to the poverty line in this country right now. In other words, what percentage of the people are living at or below poverty in this country now? Well, let's start with the states that come in. The good news, less than 20% of these states' workers are in that sad situation. I'm going to read off, it's only four states that are in that: Massachusetts, Washington, District of Columbia, and California. They've achieved a situation where 20% of their people work at that awful low income or less. Well, I'm now going to read you the states in which, I kid you not, 40% of the workers are living at that level. Here's the list of those states that are the worst. Ready? Here we go. West Virginia, Mississippi, Kentucky, South Carolina, Florida, Texas, Arkansas, and New Mexico. Most of those states are the American South. Most of those states, therefore, have a disproportionate number of people, nearly half, living at or near poverty. And most of those states vote Republican. Think about it. And by the way, it's not little businesses. That's a game. Oh, little businesses can't pay more. No, a lot of these low-wage workers are the kind who voted for that union in Staten Island. They work for huge companies, some of the biggest in the country, the Walmarts, the Amazons, the Burger King, all of that. But if you really cared and you really didn't want to hurt small business, don't put the small business owner at war with the underpaid low-wage worker. If you want to help small businesses and you don't want to do it on the backs of the poorest of the poor, give the low, small business people a subsidy. Let them be required. Pay the minimum wage. Pay better than the minimum wage. Give them an incentive. That way we deal fairly with those at the bottom and we don't penalize the small businesses. If those are goals, we can achieve them both. We do not need to sacrifice. And the way to do it, yeah, tax those at the top, those who can afford it, those who've been ripping off the poor for so long. Let's finally do what we kind of all know is the right thing to do. And now, finally, for my last update that we'll have time for, I want to talk about corporate profit and sort of tell you a story. Corporate profits currently are running close to $3 trillion here in the United States. Back in 2008, you know, when we had that last crash before the COVID crash, they were $1 trillion. I want to drive this home. At the base, at the bottom of the crash of 2008, corporate profits were about $1 trillion. Over the last 12, 13 years since then, when so many Americans have had so many difficulties with their jobs, with their incomes, and all of it, corporate profits in America went from $1 trillion to $3 trillion. Please understand, corporate America tripled its profits over the last 12 or 13 years. How many of you watching tripled your income over that period of time? I know the answer. I look at the statistics. None of you, or so few as being 0.000% of our population. And here's what that means. Through all the thick and thin of our society, whether it be Obama or Trump or Biden, one thing is clear. It's good to be a corporation here in the United States. The government takes real good care of you. Not of most of the rest of us, but of you corporations, you've tripled your income. No wonder people who run the corporations, and by the way, that includes the people who own the media, Facebook, Twitter, newspapers, television, radio, the vast preponderance of owners of our media, our sources of information, they're the ones telling you the economy is doing great. So does President Biden when he's in power. So did President Trump when he was in power. They accuse when they're out of power so they can get into power and tell us again what is in fact true for them, but not for anybody else. Corporate profits tripled from 2008 until 2022. What an amazing imbalance an economy has that works in this way. And there's a name for this system, and it really needs to be said. This is capitalism. This is the profit-driven economic system in which the corporate leaders work hard to maximize profits. And in the United States, at least, they've been doing a stellar good job of it, paying themselves huge salaries along the way. And of course, saying the economy is doing well, because that's the truth for them. And for the rest of us, not so much. I am very proud and pleased that I can bring back to our microphones and our camera someone who's become a friend as well as a teacher. Chris Hedges, you all know him, so I won't bore you with too many details. He's the author of 14 books, including several New York Times bestsellers. He's also a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who was a foreign correspondent for 15 years for the New York Times, where he served as Middle East Bureau Chief and Balkan Bureau Chief for that paper. He is the host of the Chris Hedges Report, and a columnist at SheerPost. You can find him these days at chrishedges.substack.com. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Rick.
All right, let me start. You're a journalist. You've been doing this for a long time. To me, and I want your reaction, the mainstream media coverage of the Russian invasion of Ukraine has been portrayed along the lines of a kind of holy war between good and evil. How do you see it?
Yeah, it's, and I want to just throw in that I was in Eastern Europe in 1989 as a reporter. So I covered the collapse of the Soviet bloc in Eastern and Central Europe and the demise of the Soviet Union. There were two universal assumptions. One, NATO had been rendered obsolete. NATO was designed to prevent Soviet expansion into Eastern and Central Europe. And two, any expansion of NATO beyond the borders of a unified Germany was an unnecessary and foolish provocation of Russia. In fact, Gorbachev was reaching out to try and build an alliance, a security alliance between Europe and Russia. And yet this understanding, and it was across the political spectrum, Henry Kissinger, George Kennan, everyone understood this, was violated, and it was violated because refitting Soviet bloc countries with NATO military equipment was a multi-billion dollar bonanza. So NATO was expanded despite frequent protests by Moscow. And then there was an agreement with the Clinton administration that NATO troops would not be stationed in Eastern and Central Europe, and this was violated. And we talk about Ukraine, I think, whether there's 13 or 14 former Soviet bloc countries that are now part of NATO. We talk about Ukraine as not being part of NATO. That's a bit of a subterfuge because they're a de facto part of NATO, given all of the military equipment that NATO has supplied to the Ukraine, coupled with military advisors. I think there were 150 NATO advisors in the Ukraine before the war. And now there's been this explosion of weaponry that have been shipped in from Europe and from the United States. I think close to $1 billion just from the U.S. alone. Germany has lifted its ban on the exporting of weaponry and then said it will almost triple its defense budget, and then use 2% of GDP for defense, which will make Germany the third largest military power in the world after China and the United States. So it's extremely foolhardy. I wrote a story in SheerPost where I quoted a 2008 WikiLeaks cable written out of Moscow that warned that this would bait Russia into a conflict and the flashpoint would be the Ukraine. So it was kind of like Gabriel Garcia Marquez's book, Chronicle of a Death Foretold. Everyone knew where it was moving. But try and provide that kind of historical context within the mainstream media, and of course you're shut out, because it is, you're right, it's all emotionally driven. It's about self-adulation. I mean, I guess after two decades of committing egregious war crimes in the Middle East, now we suddenly get to feel that we're the moral arbiter of the world. And I just want to be clear, I condemned at the inception the invasion of Ukraine, a preemptive war under post-Nuremberg laws, as a criminal war of aggression. Whether Russia was baited or not is not relevant, but our preemptive wars, Putin has a long way to go before he matches the war crimes that we carried out in countries like Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Afghanistan.
Let me pivot a little bit. You've been writing about, as I have been too, but you've been writing about an American empire that is falling apart or is coming apart at the seams. How do you connect that argument you've been developing for some time with this war? Where does the Ukraine war and what's happening fit into that larger story?
Well, the loss of economic hegemony, the ruling elites are attempting to compensate for that loss with military hegemony. But I think if you look in the early years of any empire, they tend to use military force very judiciously and very carefully. But of course, this is a classic example of how military force is counterproductive. And we look at all of the debacles that have been carried out by empire. Go back to Vietnam, the wars in the Middle East, the humiliating retreat from Afghanistan, the retreat under the Reagan administration from Lebanon. It's been one debacle after another. And yet they keep perpetuating these kinds of military fiascos and are not held accountable. That is a classic kind of sign of late empire, and whether that is go back to ancient Rome or Greece or anywhere else, read Thucydides. I mean, so, and I think that wielding of military force without actually calibrating it or understanding the geopolitical consequences is a symptom of late empire. And of course, we are also baiting China in the South China Sea, over Taiwan, building security alliances with Australia to kind of hem China in. These are very, very foolish moves.
You know, I'm reminded, and I would wonder if you could comment on it. The sanctions are a kind of, how shall I put it, economic warfare as an accompaniment to the military warfare. And so I look at it, you know, I'm an economist, and I say to myself, wow, the sanctions are like an enormous supply chain disruption. They're going to have, they already have, the effect of driving up the price of suddenly broken trade agreements, suddenly broken delivery schedules. Prices are going up faster than they otherwise would have. The inflation is lasting longer than folks had hoped it might. This is not really the result of the military war so much as the economic sanction warfare that's going on. And it makes you wonder whether the end result will be a level of economic suffering by all those afflicted by inflation running faster than wage increases, by the price of food literally making people starve. You're beginning to worry or wonder who's going to, quote unquote, win this so-called economic war? And it may surprise us. If you remember, Trump told us he would win the trade war. He clearly didn't. And now we're being told we're going to win this sanction war. That's not so clear to me either. How do you see it?
Yeah, well, there are two winners. One is the arms industry. And we were all very foolishly in 1989 talking about the peace dividend and naive enough to believe it. But that was never going to happen. They were going to continue to loot the state the way they did during the Cold War. And the other is the fossil fuel industry. You can't talk about war without talking about markets. You cut off Russian gas. Well, they've got to get it from the states. Europe doesn't like it because it's a lot more expensive. We can't pump oil out fast enough. And that gets into the whole issue of the blowback from the climate crisis. So those are the only real winners. But yes, we as people. And then, of course, remember, the Ukraine is a huge net exporter of wheat in particular. So, and all of this is going down the tube. So, yes. And then I think we should talk about the by imposing these draconian sanctions on Russia, we are accelerating the search. I mean, what the other irony is that we push Russia into the arms of China. So the whole Sino-Soviet alliance, that was the whole Cold War, was built around putting up a wall between Russia and China. And of course now we've created this coalition. And what they really want to do is extract the dollar as the world's reserve currency. You're an economist, you know more than I do, but they're certainly moving in that direction. That's catastrophic for the U.S. economy. Go back and look at what happened when the pound sterling in the 1950s was dropped as the world's reserve currency. Plummeting in value, exports are exponentially more expensive. Nobody wants to buy treasury bonds. That's a really catastrophic blow. So yes, I think many of the moves that Washington and NATO has taken potentially are very, very counterproductive for them.
Exactly. And you know, if we had time, I'd go into the stuff with the dollar and the fact that Russia is now demanding payment for oil in rubles, that they're linking the ruble to the gold value, which means they're putting a floor under the gold price. That shapes the United States. I mean, they're beginning to counter sanction, and we haven't even begun to understand where that's going to go on top of the first wave, you know. Right. Because with Russia and China, the counter-sanction problem becomes a very serious one, which seems not to have been calculated. But hence my question. How do you account for taking these steps, when they could be as counterproductive as you say? Is this a sign of desperation? Are we watching a Hail Mary pass here?
It's a sign of ineptitude. I mean, let's look at all of the policies, especially in terms of war, that the United States has embraced over the last few decades. It's just been disaster piled upon disaster. And yet, for this tiny cabal, arms manufacturers, the fossil fuel industry, private contractors, they make a killing. So what you've had is this kind of corporate coup d'etat. You service the profits and interests of these corporations at the expense of the nation and, frankly, at the expense of our democracy, and they're driving the country into the ground. And then if we talk again, go back to the climate crisis, the rest of the planet with us. So it's utter ineptitude and corruption on the part of a global ruling elite, which is Julian Assange exposed through the leaking of all sorts of documents, which is why they are psychologically and physically destroying him in Belmarsh prison. I just came back from London. I was one of six guests invited to his wedding. And of course, when the six of us got to the gates of Belmarsh, none of us were allowed in, just part of the kind of sadism that defines prison culture. I teach in a prison. So, yes, it is. But again, that is a symptomatic of late empire, where you compound problems through rulers who are so corrupt and so visionless and so inept that you, in many ways, become your own worst enemy.
Chris, in the time that we have, do you see any link between everything you've been saying and the upsurge of at least some degree of labor militancy inside the United States, whether it be in strikes or the unionization efforts? Are we beginning to see some level of recognition and pushback against what you've just been saying?
Yes, because the ruling elites, and it doesn't matter whether they're Republican or Democrat, have zero credibility. The established elites, because remember, there's a fusion now between the old Republican establishment, the Mitt Romneys, the Liz Cheneys, the Bill Kristols, and the Democratic Party. They are one entity, and they are opposed by this kind of proto-fascist, Christian fascist, cult-like worship of Donald Trump. But of course, their way to deal with it is through censorship. So I think on the ground, yes, people have realized that nobody in the ruling elite is going to watch out for their interests. They've got to watch out for their own. But take a look at my column, Let Us Now Praise Courageous Men and Women, that talks about how vicious the capitalist class is going to be in terms of breaking and destroying this nascent labor movement.
Chris, as usual, we've come to the end. I want to thank you very much for joining us. And to my audience, stay up to date with the latest from Democracy at Work. Join our mailing list. And as always, I look forward to speaking with you again.
That was a recent discussion with Richard Wolff and Chris Hedges that aired on Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. And this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time on your community radio stations WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis. I'll be with you again next week for another edition.